Hello, this is the Westminster Standard. I'm Ryan Beasy. Today, I am joined by Teaching Elder Ben Ratliff and Teaching Elder Nate Zanders. Welcome to the program. Nate, last time you were on, we had Professor Sean Rittenour, and give us an update on your family since then. How are you?
Everybody's doing well. My wife and our youngest are traveling back from Hawaii today, actually. She was out there, representing her dad at a work event. Her dad's been fighting cancer out in Arizona for several months now, and the latest report is stunningly good. And so hopefully he'll be home here in East Tennessee in the next several weeks. To kind of give you a picture of his prognosis in October, there was like three or four different doctors that basically said, just go home, eat whatever you want, love your grandkids. You're probably not going to see Christmas. And they literally said, go home, eat ice cream, be with your family. You'll be lucky to see 2024. And now it looks like he's going to, in his own words, be around to bother us for a little bit longer. so we're thrilled about that. And my parents have our two oldest boys today, which frees me up to do this without wondering if one of them is going to come blasting through that glass door over there in a vehicle of some sort. So we're doing great. Really thankful for God's goodness to my father-in-law and to us as a family. So we're doing well.
Wonderful. Thanks for being on. And you don't have a podcast yet, right?
Not yet. No.
Not yet. Okay. And Ben, you are a prolific podcaster from Polity Matters, perhaps my favorite podcast to listen to. I look forward every Tuesday to when y'all come out with some great content.
All my jokes are made just for you, Ryan, because my co-hosts don't laugh at them, but I know that you do. So
I do. Yeah. That's my workout, actually, in the car. As I chuckle, I get an ab workout.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on. Glad to be here.
And where are you ministering now? You're in Covenant Cleveland?
Yeah, that's right. Go back a little further than that, brother. You and I graduated from RTS Jackson together.
We did.
11 years ago, I was thinking about it. But now I'm an associate minister at Covenant PCA here in Cleveland, Mississippi, member of Covenant Presbytery, just cruising. My wife and I have been married 15 years coming up, and we have four little girls, six and under. So life is busy, and we love it. So it's good. It's good times.
Previously pastor at First Pres Hazelhurst, is that right?
When I was down in Grace Presbytery, I was doing First Pres Hazelhurst and First Pres Wesson at the same time for a little while. It was a good time down in Grace. And before that, after school, was in, I was ordained in Heritage Presbytery up in the Eastern Shore of Maryland right after school. So it's been, we think we've settled. I keep telling my wife, I'm pretty sure we'll stay here for a little bit longer. So.
Yeah. And you were an RUF intern at Belhaven College at that time.
Back when I was going through RTS, we were allowed to do part-time internships, and so I had gone to Belhaven for my undergrad, and so they let me come back and do a part-time internship there, which was great. It was good. I was there when the whole shakeup happened and the Mississippi system went back underneath the sort of federal system in Georgia. But got to work with Bebo Elkin for most of my internship, which was really good. So,
right. Yeah, and Nate. Nate, you are just outside of Knoxville in Louisville at Christ the King Church. Is that still the case? Hasn't changed since January.
Nope. Yeah, we're still there, we're hoping to purchase that building sometime this year, so we hope to be in Louisville for the long haul. But we'll see what God's providence brings our way, so that's where our church is meeting for worship currently. Yeah.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, I want to talk about today how the PCA has changed since 2018, 2019, and particularly what role media has had in that change. Back at the end of General Assembly in 2018, the National Partnership reflected As always, my last note is full of bullet points because it's all I've got at the end of the week. The leadership of the PCA was further clarified this week. The people leading the denomination are Erwin Intz, Alex Chen, Lloyd Kim, Derek Halverson, Howie Donahoe, Larry Hoop, Bruce O'Neill, Sean Lucas, Mike Kanjan. That's a good group. We're in good hands. That's an incredible change from 6 years ago when we started the national partnership. And then some other reflections on that Atlanta assembly. So there was this enthusiasm about the PCA and the General Assembly. Has the trajectory changed in the PCA since 2018? You guys, you know, that's about half your ordained life, right? Between now and 2018.
Yeah, that's even predating my ordination. I was ordained in 2019, but, okay. You know, but I was paying attention. I was a licentiate at the time. So I was paying attention to the General Assembly and kind of the landscape of things. But yeah, so this whole trajectory that we're talking about from then to now is that's my basically my whole life as a PCA preacher and teaching elder.
So you may be the reason, you and Job DeLumba, perhaps the reason.
Well,
the trajectory.
I was actually
is that it? Shall we? Just
I was actually
going to
say,
now?
Well, what happened was in 2019, they messed up and ordained me, and that caused a seismic shift. The force was disturbed in the PCA, and no, that has nothing to do with it. It's a fly on the wall in the grand scheme of the PCA, pretty much.
Yeah, but do you know, Ben, we were roommates then in 2018 at the GA there at the Hyatt in Atlanta, I remember.
Oh, man.
What has changed since then? I mean, there was Revoice. That was just bubbling under the surface. It hadn't, I think, you know, it had just happened or was about to happen, and people were talking about it at the GA, but there was nothing that could be done. What has caused the change, or what's different about GA now?
Well, I think the numbers certainly speak for GA to some degree. And you know, everybody wants to point to, you know, higher ruling elder participation, which is good. You know, I'm sure we'll see it ebb and flow over the years, because as we have reason to go to General Assembly and vote on significant things that show up, we'll see more ruling elders appear. I've wondered, you know, is it possible that we just kind of had, you know, drifted away a little bit for a few moments and Revoice occurred and sort of called everybody back, as it were, to pay attention and not to shift too quickly. But the other thought I've had is that, you know, you look around right now and there's a lot of ministers, a lot of young elders, let's say that, because even ruling elders, there's a lot of young elders involved in the PCA now that I don't remember 5 or 6 or 8 years ago. Some of them are guys our age, right? The three of us who were in seminary 10 years ago, just getting out. And now we kind of feel like we have enough experience to stir things up a little bit. Not necessarily to do any good, but at least to bring things to the forefront. And I think that's really helped to have young men, standing up and speaking. We've got young guys on our session that have just come on. They're, you know, in their mid thirties, that are interested and engaged. I think that is a huge factor in the shift, you know, from 5 years ago.
So you talk about, you know, ruling elders. Back in 2022, there was a tweet that was posted, you know, extolling ruling elders, but asserting that they shouldn't participate in the courts beyond the local court, you know, where they haven't been called and ordained by that court. On the Polity Matters podcast, y'all just finished up the marks of the apostolic, or what is the true church, the apostolic church, which is it? And I think Witherell gives 6 marks of a true church, biblical. How does this idea that no ruling elders participating outside the local church, how does that fit in with what y'all discussed about Witherell, what Witherell argues?
Well, sure. I mean, this would fit more in line with some kind of episcopacy what's the phrase?
Prelacy.
Prelacy. Thank you. Yeah, you should come on and talk about that sometime. We need somebody that knows what they're doing.
Number one fan right here.
Oh, man. I mean, I looked at this tweet and just thought it seems very confused. Commonly, elders are not called by a court. They're called by congregation. Right. The irony is that an assistant is actually called by a court, and that's a whole other debate, I suppose, about assistants. So there's just some confusion in here. But the whole notion that ruling elders shouldn't be involved is just ridiculous. I mean, churches are members of presbyteries. How did churches send representation to presbytery? Well, through their ruling elders, who they've elected to go and serve for them, not just on their session, but also at presbytery and correspondingly at General Assembly. So if you want participation in the courts of the church, it has to be through your ruling elders. It's necessary.
Mm. Yeah. So you're right. That was my thought about this tweet, is it's very confused about how it works. He's probably not actually confused. It's just the way that he's worded it. I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt.
Sure.
The way that he's worded it, if you knew nothing about the PCA, you would think some things that aren't true. So I've said this before, and most people get it. It amazes me that not everybody understands that this is just true. But I've said this before online, and people are like, really? I don't think that's the way that works. But academic institutions typically break left. Mm. They're started by conservatives. Eventually, progressives hop on board because progressives don't start institutions. They just take them over.
Besides Harvard, Princeton, Yale, what can you give any other examples?
Literally every single Ivy League school and most other schools.
Even Grove City College at one point, you know, was breaking left.
Sure.
And came back under the tenureship of Charles McKenzie. So yeah, I'm being facetious, but you're exactly right.
A great book on this, and it's a great book because you don't know what the author actually believes. He's just giving you the facts. Hmm. He traces, it's called The History of Soul Care in America. I think that's right. And the subtitle is From Salvation to Self-Actualization. And he just kind of traces the journey from the 1600s and the colonies to where we are now in like the late 1990s, early 2000s, in terms of how pastoral work is done. But you just see how many times throughout this history book where institutions are clearly going more and more left. So institutions are pumping out teaching elders, right? They go to Bible college, they go to seminary, they go to both maybe, whatever. And so they are trained in the academy. And so if you have a presbytery, which is what ordains, the congregation calls the teaching elder, but it's the presbytery that examines him and then ordains him. And if you have a presbytery that is nothing but fellow teaching elders, then all of the, excuse the phrase, gatekeepers, like all the people trying to, because remember, the Presbyterian system is we're not just responsible for shepherding our own congregation, but for the general care of the various churches in our presbytery. And one of the ways that we exercise that is by making sure that when they call a minister, that he's actually ready for the job, and he's actually sound theologically. So if your goal is to have teaching elders that are exactly like you and they break left and they have kind of this Episcopalian vision for the Presbyterian world, then this is a great idea. Just have nothing but academically trained teaching elders, formally trained teaching elders examine their fellow teaching elders. And that's what will be produced. The ruling elders are the backbone, not just of the local church, but of the PCA as a whole. And without ruling elders serving on committees and commissions and laboring and examinations, the PCA would be in a very different place right now. And for the three of us, we think that alternative universe would be a nightmare. And for other guys, they would really like it. So this is one of just the fundamental disagreements amongst people in the PCA, is whether or not this vision or that vision would be better.
Right. And there would be no PCA without ruling elders. Of course, there might be something else, but the PCA.
There'd be no RTS without ruling elders.
There'd be no RTS. Yeah, yeah. I would have gone to... I don't know where I would have gone. I mean, yeah, ruling elders are the means God has used to form the PCA. So, you know, we're hearing, you know, or reading these statements about ruling elders should not be permitted to participate. It sounds like presbytery or General Assembly. And then much more recently, there was a tweet that went out that said our National Assembly is broken. What has changed? Sam DiSocio was a member of the National Partnership. So in 2018, there was this enthusiasm. What are we now? Just, I don't do math very often. I guess that's what, 6 years later, we're hearing our National Assembly is broken. What's going on? Why are we hearing these calls and cries? What has changed?
not to be harsh, but all that's really changed is the broader PCA world became aware of the national partnership. Ruling elders increasingly showed up at General Assembly, and overtures didn't go their way. And at times it didn't go their way because strong minority reports came forward from the overtures committee, and the larger assembly was persuaded by those minority reports. And so overtures went in directions that they didn't want them to go. I would agree with him that there's, I wouldn't say it's broken. I would say that there's problems with the PCA at the national level, but for different reasons than probably he would. Yeah. He would say, if that makes sense.
Well, and there's dysfunction in any organization, but to say that our National Assembly is broken, I mean, that grieves me that might even be possible. I think, you know, what we've seen over the last couple of years has been a return to our foundation, a renaissance of Thornwellian Presbyterianism. Kenny Silla, big if true, but, you know, focused on the federal powers. And then now Dave Silvernail, a veteran, you know, a certainly a father in the faith, says that things are getting better in the PCA. A recently demitted member of the National Partnership says that, well, what it is the toxin of white Christian nationalism, and that we treat every issue as if it is a Trinitarian controversy. Is there some truth to this?
Well, we don't have time to go through that whole thread that he left. There's just it's a logically incoherent thread. It doesn't make sense. And I kind of my view on stuff like this is, show me where there's white Christian nationalism, and I will, despite our differences, link arms with you and fight it. But if what you mean is there's white Southern conservatives that are keeping me from getting my way, that's not Christian nationalism. That's just you not getting your way. So whenever someone says something like this, it's like, just give me one example. Show me what you're talking about so that we can deal with it. But you can't just look at someone and say, there's a toxin and it's here. Well, show me the blood work. You know, there's a toxin in this body. Let's give me an example.
I was saddened to read this. I mean, I pastored for 5 years in Mississippi. It was a small town, a wonderful small congregation. There was definitely some racism in the congregation. I mean, I was sitting in my office, and you know, one of the deacons came in and used the N-word twice in my presence, and the session, you know, took action. You know, when I found in our session minutes that back in 1954, the session had banned people of color from coming into the church for worship, I brought that to my session, and they said, well, we need to repeal that policy. Now, we had already been violating our policy, but we said, we need to go on record and appeal to repeal that policy. So, you know, if anywhere there was going to be, you know, white Christian nationalism, it would have been there. And when it did rear its head, these elders took action to rebuke and correct the past. Ben, I'm sure you've seen examples of that, you know, where you are in the Delta, the Mississippi Delta.
Yeah, certainly. Sorry, my internet failed there for a second. A child tripped over a cord, I'm sure, inside the house. So I, you know, anyway, the transition to this slide, I have been impressed to see in the PCA more attempts to move in a good direction from that, away from the past, than I have heard people sort of doubling down on what we used to do. I never ran into anybody that was like, yeah, those policies from the 50s, we really need to uphold those. No, everybody's very willing. And even to your point, like, maybe they didn't even realize we had a policy like that, and they're just they're living in a whole new way than they used to, because the Lord's sanctified them over the last, you know, 70 years, and their generations. And so there's, you know, it's oftentimes people aren't living in the middle of those things. They're just, you know, Oh, goodness, my brain.
Yeah. Well, what
they've moved past it in a lot of ways.
Yes. 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 Well, what role do you think blogs and podcasts have played in this this transformation of the PCA? Are these blogs and podcasts a sign that we've become increasingly politicized, or is this a sign of health and interest?
I mean, I think I'm bound to say that it's a sign of health and interest. I mean, I don't have any money riding on that, but maybe, you know,
yeah.
One day when my media empire explodes, we'll bring you in under our umbrella, Ryan. But maybe it'll be the other way around. It's probably almost.
I'd love to be under somebody's umbrella. That way it doesn't rain in here. And
it'll be a really big umbrella, almost like a tent.
Big tent.
It'll be really, yeah. Really big. That's right. Yeah, something like that. That's a
we'll
good
call
line.
It Tabernacle Media.
I mean, I can speak to this a little bit from Polity Matters, yeah, side of things. Our idea for Polity Matters, it arose from situations that I observed in my own presbytery where congregants and elders alike, and let's be fair, on both sides of the proverbial aisle, seemed to have little to no functional knowledge of our polity.
Right.
And so Polity Matters started as a way to educate people on our Constitution. And we looked around and thought, well, there's people talking about the standards, you know, the confession and the shorter and the larger catechisms have all been represented in some audio format. What about the BCO, which is so exciting and lively, and, you know, everybody wants to talk about that endlessly. But it has been very fruitful. Mm. I've heard from several listeners over the course of the last, you know, 6 months or so, and I trust that more are the same way, that they listen in order to serve the church. You know, they're not listening. I mean, nobody's listening to a podcast about polity because they have time to waste, right? Right. It's, we're hopefully serving a purpose. And so while reading our book can be confusing on its own, and I'll be the first one to admit that it was difficult getting into it and learning about it, but listening to somebody else or listening to a group of men talk about it together and explain it and tell stories about how it's been implemented makes the book digestible. It makes our polity approachable. You know, reading books like Thomas Witherow and talking through it so that people can listen, it helps the Presbyterian polity become much more approachable. I think in a lot of ways, many of the media sources we have now are serving the church, period.
Yeah.
It's not because we're bored. It's not because we don't have enough to do. It's because we're actually trying to serve our people more, and because more people are paying attention to these things because of the way broader media has erupted in the last 10 or 15 years, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm in agreement with you. I mean, I think I had congregants that were aware that, like, Jude 3, for example, existed before I did. You know, there's an increase, I think, in the average Joe and the average Jane in the PCA pew. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't have time to read blogs on the way to work, but they can listen to a podcast. And so they can catch up on, you know, or try to grasp what's going on in the greater PCA. And also I think, you know, I think that a lot of people in the PCA, they think their individual PCA church, that's the PCA. That's every PCA church is like this. That's the way I thought, yeah, from age
that's
9.
That's the PCA
until,
for you.
Yeah. And then I went off to seminary and started visiting various churches in St. Louis. And I was like, oh, the PCA comes in all different shapes and sizes and you know, different elements, different personalities, et cetera, different perspectives.
And when the two of us get together, we have the long and the short of it. So
that's right. We're Jeff and Mud. So basically, I think that what the blogosphere and the podcast world does is it actually helps those PCA congregants that have only been to one PCA or two PCA churches ever, is, mm-hmm, they kind of get a bigger sense of what's going on, and it kind of helps them understand, you mean that there's people in the PCA that think that side B theology is a good idea, or they think that it's okay to identify as, you know, and then all of a sudden you have people that are like, hey, we really need to get our ruling elders to court, you know, to presbytery, to GA, you know, so there, I just think it helps the average congregant. I also think it serves, I also think blogs and podcasts serve the solo teaching elder really well and ruling elders. You know, so I think they're an overall benefit to the congregation and to you know, to the solo teaching elder that's wearing all kinds of different hats, and needs kind of an ability to, an outlet or a mechanism where they can kind of quickly digest what's going on in the PCA from various perspectives. So I think it's a good service to the average person in the PCA.
Yeah, that's what struck me about this tweet. I see more shows, podcasts, and articles on church politics, whereas Dave Silvernail, you know, a veteran pastor, says, "Well, this isn't exclusive of the local church, and you know, getting the local members involved and zealous for the health of the PCA, I think, is a good thing."
Yeah,
you know, in the 19th century, there were all sorts of Presbyterian newspapers. You know, the Louisville Presbyterian. I don't think you're Louisville, Nate.
No.
But, but you know, and the Southern Presbyterian Journal. I was reading an article written by Thomas Peck in 1863, and you know, there was a little disturbance going on in 1863. But it was this, you know, arcane article about the nature of the church to the state, and I was like, wow, this is 1863. Of all the things you have going on right now, you have the time to write this, number one. Two, the resources to put this into print. Three, to distribute it. These kind of things are important to Presbyterians, even during a season of national conflagration.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think one of the it's a pro and a con, right, of blogs and podcasts is you can deliver it much faster. I mean, and so there's I have concerns with that. It allows us to talk to each other more frequently and faster, but it also allows us to fortify the walls of our echo chambers.
And talk past each other because we're talking
past each other more often. It also, you know, the reality is that like just think about corporate news media. It's not about who's right and who's accurate. It's about who's first. Certainly that can bleed into presbymedia, if you will, you know, because we're human beings just like they are, share the same human nature. And there can be, I think about the damage that can be caused by one misquote, something ripped out of context, and then all of a sudden you've got 10,000 people. Or you know, probably not that many, 5,000 people, all of a sudden, they have a perspective on something that they don't have all the facts. And the reality is that we've become a guilty until proven innocent culture. So there's serious upside and serious downside to the speed at which people are able to get information out into the world.
Yeah.
Along those lines, my wife, I haven't actually read Neil Postman's Amusing Ourselves to Death, but my wife has been reading it lately and has been reading to me in a lot of cases, just sort of, you'll never believe what he said and how applicable this is to the day and age. I'm like, yeah, it's pretty crazy. But the one thing we've been talking about a lot is, you know, news and what you should be paying attention to is something that affects you today, right? That elicits an action from you in some ways, or that affects your day in a substantial sense. And so we do have to be careful and have, you know, sort of walk very wisely and not be consumed with news for the sake of news, you know, just, hey, I've got all this information now. I don't know what to do with it. You know, there's nothing really to do with it except that it's stuck in my head. There's plenty of better things to stick in your head. Sometimes in the case of all this PCA stuff, right, there's lots that can be put to use. You know, live streaming of services has led to some, you know, discussions between teaching elders and presbyteries, right, about certain churches and their practices.
Yeah.
That's not a bad thing. We should be careful not to become watchdogs on everybody's live stream service all the time. But, you know, again, I think Nate's on point. You have to balance it. There's good and bad.
Right.
Echo chambers, man. You said my buzzword for podcast. I listen to podcasts. I'm like, man, I can't do this. This is just an echo chamber. Everybody's saying the same thing. And it's hard to get guys on, right, on the other side, which is what, I don't know if you said it live or not, but I love the idea that you've got, if you were ever going to start a podcast.
Yeah, that's right. If I ever did start a podcast, you know, the sole purpose of it would be just to have two guys that don't agree. You know, if I can't get them to sit down in person. What I've often said is if I was just independently wealthy, I would build my own version of the Joe Rogan Experience studio and just fly guys in and be like, let's just sit down like men, you know, smoke a cigar, drink some whiskey and just hash this out. You know, but that's probably not going to be possible. But so the next best thing would be to have a podcast where just two guys can have hopefully a good faith conversation where they're actually talking to one another and not past each other and subtweeting each other. And I think it's the least manly thing we do these days is to subtweet each other and to talk past each other. And it's time. Let's make the PCA manly again and actually just square up and talk to one another and see what happens. That would be my idea for a podcast.
You can make a hat out of that. Make the PCA manly again.
Yeah.
It should be red with white letters on it.
Maybe. Yeah, that wouldn't cause problems at all.
No, not at all.
Yeah. So from 1999 to 2004, there was the Presbyterian and Reformed News, which was a newspaper that attempted to do what a lot of podcasts and blogs are doing now. And there was huge seismic shifts that were going on in the Reformed world with Federal Vision, Good Faith Subscriptions, women's roles, all swirling around at that time. And you know, I think it was Mel Duncan on a previous episode said he was really a blogger or a podcaster ahead of his time, because you know, this was the late 90s. And Frank Smith noted on Presbycast that there was resistance to a newspaper back then. And I think we're still seeing today resistance to blogs and non-official podcasts. Let me play that clip from Presbycast. Did you want to say something before I do?
I'm curious, when you say non-official podcasts, what in particular you're referring to?
Well,
meaning podcasts that aren't produced by any of our permanent committees and agencies.
That's what I gather from not the people in Atlanta, but people, you know, other teaching elders throughout the denomination. That why do we have all these non-official, these underground, you know, podcasts? Let's see what Smith said.
It's very tumultuous, late 90s, early 2000s. And I think your publication, and I'm going to put it up on the screen in a minute, an example of it. You know, you all were banned from distributing copies outside of General Assembly, as I recall.
Well, technically inside the building.
Okay.
We got banned outside. And so we went out like into the place where people would come in and so forth. But yeah, I think it was at the Dallas Assembly where anything being distributed inside where the meeting was taking place. Because what we would do, it wasn't just the newspaper, but then for General Assembly, we would prepare these news bulletins. And what I would do is I would write the story and stay up till 2 o'clock in the morning, probably doing that. And then get up around 6 o'clock and go to Kinko's or whatever and get 1,000 copies made. And in order to distribute it to the men who were coming into General Assembly that morning. And so we tried to provide a service. Matter of fact, that's how it started. Seriously, 1995, the PCA magazine, PCA Messenger had ceased publication at the end of 1994. And one of my good friends was Dr. Edwin Elliott of the Christian Observer magazine. And one of the things that he said was, he talked about the Joseph principle, that is to lead by serving, just like Joseph served. And that really is what we were trying to do. We weren't trying to be the National Enquirer of the PCA. But unfortunately, we quickly turned into that, if you will, or perhaps the Presbyterian layman of the PCA, because there were so many scandals that were going on. Again, we didn't try just to concentrate on those things. We tried to run nice stories and so forth. But there, as you said, there was a lot that was going on in terms of interchurch relations, shilling for the Christian Reformed Church in North America, the story out of Madrid, Spain. That was one of the first issue that we had dealt with that, where PCA missionaries, MTW missionaries were told not to baptize their children in public worship because it would be confusing to the Spanish who were Catholic. So those are the kinds of things that were going on. So it wasn't so much, when we talk about scandal, it wasn't so much financial, but it was doctrinal. And it was not, in a sense, it wasn't hard to find, if you will. And people would often come to us with those stories. And that was not the original. The original thing was not to be the scandal sheet of the PCA. But it turned out that way in many ways, just because of the nature of the case.
Well, of course, you know, you had a point of view, and that came through, I'm sure, in selection of material and the way it was reported. And just as some in the new media are not that popular with the powers that be, and some of the movers and shakers in the PCA, you were not all that popular either.
We were not on their Christmas card list, so to speak.
Well, you know, if they sent you one, it might have had a second commandment violation on it, so maybe you should be thankful for that.
One time, this was, I think, 1999, the PCA, the Presbytery State Clerks often would go into Atlanta every year. They weren't required to, but to talk with the State Clerk or the Associate State Clerk of the General Assembly. And so we got some notes from that meeting, including how the powers that be were saying, oh, be sure to copyright your minutes so no one can quote them. Well, just because, as you know, just because you copyright something doesn't mean no one can quote them. But nevertheless, they were basically trying to play keep away with their presbytery minutes. And because they didn't like the fact that we were publishing what the presbyteries were doing, providing that information. And not all of it, like I said, not all of it was scandalous. They just didn't like the fact we were doing it. And they were also saying things like, oh yeah, this is just when the internet was starting to make, was to be in vogue and people were concerned about privacy. And it's like, yeah, you can go up there on the internet, but maybe your name or your photograph as minister should be password protected. I mean, just bizarre things. So I called up the grand poobah of the state of Georgia, the fellow that was the Freemason fellow here. And what was interesting in talking with him is you go to their website and they have all kinds of information about their officers, their, you know, the Tyler, the grand, whatever, and so forth. He also said, we have never, as far as I know, we have never denied a request for someone to come in and read our minutes. And so, of course, you compare that to what the PCA was doing in terms of trying to play keep away. So that's why I say we were not the most popular with the bureaucrats, shall we say.
Well, that's commentary on a different era, right? You know, the 25 years ago, a quarter century ago, where there seems, at least to Frank Smith, to have been a resistance to independent media in the PCA, whereas now there are all of these blogs, podcasts, networks, you know, the GRN, A4MR. It's just a different age. So Presbyterian News was definitely ahead of its time, but there are still voices today suggesting that, you know, blogs and podcasts are doing more harm than good. Jason Cornwall, this also comes with blogs and podcasts, it seems more busybody than discernment. Just is this discontent? What is the role of Presbyterian media, especially non-official? You know, Frank Smith said, you know, we weren't popular with the powers that be. What is the role of podcasts like this, like Polity Matters, your podcast when you started up, Nate?
That's right.
Yeah. So, man, I would, if I was in person with Jason, I would ask, this is the question I would ask him, and I would ask anybody.
And we did invite him to come on, but he was okay. Unavailable. So
yeah, this is the question I would ask anybody with that opinion, whether they're from the evangelical tribe or the missional tribe or the confessional tribe. My question to them would be, if the other two tribes were completely radio silent and the only platformed perspective was yours and it was coming up aces, everything, people are listening, it's causing a movement in the, like it's causing people in the pews to be convinced, it's shaping ruling elders and deacons and their opinions, would you really hold that view? I don't know the answer for Jason. I don't know the answer for anybody else that holds that view. I highly doubt these guys were thinking this way in 2018, right? We, as human beings, we like it when the other side, whatever that other tribe is that we're wrestling with or disagreeing with, we tend to be okay with it when they're having to take their medicine. But when the spoon comes around and there's no sugar with it for us, we're upset about it. That's just that. That's human. That's human nature. Happens every 4 to 8 years in civil politics. All of a sudden, the Democrats will discover the Constitution of the United States. All of a sudden, they'll care about the Bill of Rights when their guy's not in power.
All of a sudden, Republicans will care about fiscal responsibility.
All of a sudden, yeah, it's incredible. It is. I don't like it when the sword is in the other hand. Mm. You know, that's what it is. And so, but that it could not be for, that may not be the case for Jason. He could just be, you know, he could see what, maybe he's commenting on what I've seen, which is the echo chamber, you know, guys, not everybody, but individuals. And this is another thing we do. We typically take the actions of one or two guys and we say, everybody in his tribe is like this. And it's just not the case. But we do see a lot of guys, they seem to just want to saber rattle, stir up their, fortify their base. They don't have an interest in coming on a podcast and actually duking it out with someone else. And by that, I just mean having a robust conversation where guys don't agree.
A manly conversation.
A manly conversation where we're just honest with each other. And we don't posture and we don't try to look for ways to have plausible deniability. We just come right out and say stuff. And I tell you, Ryan, that's one of the things I really appreciated about our presbytery. I served on a committee to deal with some of our overtures. And there's six guys in the room, and I agreed with two of them and disagreed with three of them. And it was really nice to sit down and break bread with guys and to understand, to be able to understand, this is your position and this is why. I care way more about why someone holds their position than what their position is. Because, you know, there's guys that hold the position that I hold on critical race theory or side B theology. And when you talk to them about it, it's like, man, that's your opinion's icky. Like, to borrow language from my 5-year-old, like, that's a terrible take, you know? And then there's guys that they vote the opposite way that I vote. And then I hear them and I go, oh, okay. Like, I think you're wrong, but I understand your position and I can respect the way you came to that conclusion. So anyway, I went on a bit of a ramble there, but those are my thoughts about that tweet. And I just, I think it's if you're a conservative or a traditionalist, whatever you want to call it, I think you've got to be looking at this flood of new podcasts and blogs and you're going, this is good. We're finally, because here's the deal about conservatives. Conservatives build institutions, but it seems like progressives, and this is not just true in the church, I think it's outside the culture. Conservatives build institutions, progressives and liberals build platforms. And conservatives are always behind in building a platform, using platforms. We're always 10 steps behind on using Twitter, using blogs, using video, all this stuff. And progressives and liberals are always ahead of the game. And now all of a sudden, one of the big shifts in the PCA is the conservative evangelicals and the confessionalists, right? The cultural conservatives have figured out how the internet works and how Twitter works and they've come alive. And,
that little whistle in their computer, you know, they can dial up to the internet now.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
We turned fiber it off optics, and turned it back on that? Again. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Let me just, you know, we're to use a video game analogy, conservatives and confessionals, we're still blowing into the cartridges and like tapping the Super Nintendo. And you know, progressives and liberals they're like, you still put discs in your PlayStation? We just download the game from the internet and we're up and running, you know? So anyway, that's my analogy for what's happened is, you know, we've stopped knuckle dragging and we figured out how technology works and we're like, let's use this for the kingdom and let's build a platform. Cause here's the thing. Like, I remember, I won't mention his name. This is for him to out himself, but he, you know, I had a guy text me 3 or 4 years ago. He's like, I'm hesitating with using Twitter and the internet and writing articles he was hesitant to have any sort of like public persona or build a platform. And I'm like, man, if you were a progressive, you wouldn't even ask this question. Mm-hmm. We'd be talking about how you're going to brand yourself rather than whether or not you should do this. So I think that's a fundamental difference between the culture and in the church, and conservatives have just started to figure stuff out. That's my take on it.
Yeah, it does seem like there is just a flood of new podcasts for the PCA. You know, we've talked about Polity Matters. You know, this is obviously a podcast, if anyone didn't know. I mean, there's PresbyCast, which, yeah. And PresbyCast is sort of the godfather of the, you know, unofficial, you know, the podcasts and news in the PCA. I mean, Ben, it was you who got me interested in PresbyCast. I think I listened to my first PresbyCast episode driving to Atlanta for that assembly. You said, hey, I'm going to listen to this podcast and you helped me get ready for GA. And I was like, oh, what's that?
And I'm so sorry.
But there's a plethora of them. George Sayer and I just did a crossover podcast where we interviewed somebody together with the Presbyterian Reformed Churchman that he puts out. There's a number of them. And you know, then there's the True Believer podcast, which is more focused on an event at your alma mater there, Nate, but coming from a different perspective on the PCA than a lot of these new podcasts. So it's not just one side, although I do think the old school conservative side of the PCA is pumping out so much material. So there's an enthusiasm on this side of the PCA now that there wasn't 5-10 years ago.
I've got a lot of thoughts about that podcast you just mentioned, but that might be for a different.
That will totally be for a totally different episode, and we would love to have you back to talk about that. So, you know, there are a lot of potential issues with podcasts and blogs, right? You know, there's a lot of warnings in the scripture about a multitude of words. Now, in the late 90s, though, and early 2000s, so concurrent with the Presbyterian News, there was something called the Presbyterian Pastoral Leadership Network in the PCA. And they were aiming to move the PCA in a more, I guess today, what we would call a more missional direction. I mean, here's from, you know, screenshots from their website, which you can still find on archive.org. Renewal within the Reformed tradition, new leadership. A lot of this, I think, was manifested in the strategic plan, which was that in 2011, 2010, that assembly.
Was innovative. Discussed. That was one of the Apostle Paul's favorite words, I think.
Yes, and nuanced. Mm-hmm. It was a passion for peace and justice, cultural engagement, Reformed Catholicity. What they did, and I've tried to block out, I Googled all of these numbers and they were all like official, like, you know, that 314 number is the number for Covenant College. So we're not doxing anyone here, but, just in case any of the emails are still active, I've covered those up, but they're all, you know, of business phone numbers. But one of the things they did is they sent a letter saying, this is who we are. This is what we're doing. We would like to get elders and pastors involved, particularly pastors. So the PPLN, in their public advocacy for their perspective on the PCA, they appealed to especially the professional clergy and ruling elders to some extent, but especially professional clergy. But what I see these blogs and this podcast and many others are also trying to inform unordained people to get them interested. Is there a difference? And is that right for us to try to do that in a Presbyterian system? Should we target only the ordained folks or only the clergy, which I think we know the answer is no to that one, but or is it okay for us to, we want to inform the regular member, the housewife with her two kids, we want her to know what's going on in the Lord's church as well.
Yeah.
I think I would just say that we don't want to distract people. You know, I can speak for my wife. I don't want my wife, you know, I don't want to come home and find out she's listened to 5 hours of podcasts about the PCA and the children are, you know, searching for crumbs because they haven't eaten all day. Right. And there's dirt everywhere. That doesn't happen. But at the same time, there's a balance, right? I think it's wise for people to know what's going on. And maybe, you know, they need to strike a balance of, okay, I don't need to know everything that's happening. I don't need to know every jot and tittle of the BCO, but I'm going to listen to this episode of Polity Matters or this episode of PresbyCast in order to learn about this particular thing because it's interesting or because it's a big deal. You know, I can imagine during the Revoice situation, there was probably some good information for regular congregants to have. There might be some things that are only suitable or only necessary, maybe necessary is the word, for pastors and ruling elders to understand. Oh, I'm sorry. I just went three office. I'm so sorry. Just teaching elders and ruling elders, you know, to understand. There's a balance. I mean, we've been saying that over and over again, right? The last 45 minutes. There's kind of both sides of this.
Yeah. Balance is everything.
Yeah. My perspective is, I mean, there's, so I am a current RTS student. So, you know, in a couple of years, we'll be able to thank you. And so all my buddies are getting like demons from RTS. I'm just getting a counseling degree. People are like, what's your doctorate in? I'm like, it's another master's. I'm not smart enough to get a doctorate. But one of the things that I realized very quickly, like 10 seconds into pastoral ministry is the MDiv does not prepare you for every single aspect of ministry. And so I'm thankful that you know, I'm thankful that organizations or networks, whatever you want to call it, guys just kind of collaborate together. I'm glad that that exists because of being a teaching elder, especially for me when I just went from unordained to immediately solo teaching elder. And so there's aspects of the job that you just don't get in seminary. And depending on which seminary you go to, you either don't get much of it at all, or you get nothing. And so just trying to help teaching elders navigate church courts, figure out Robert's rules, all that stuff. That's good, because if the teaching elder doesn't know, the ruling elders probably aren't going to know either. I mean, unless you got a seasoned veteran ruling elder who's been, then he can kind of help the teaching elder. But in church planting situations or church revitalization situations, that ain't happening. So, right. You know, balance is a great word, and there is a real need for teaching elders to just be able to figure out the other aspects of the job that the MDiv just didn't cover, because you can't cover everything. You know, it'd have to be like a 300 credit hour degree in order to cover every little aspect of ministry. So,
and that's not the purpose of academic training. Academic training is to get you the tools so you can figure out the rest of it.
That's right.
You go to get a PhD in historical theology so you can be a professor at, you know, some undergraduate institution. They haven't taught you everything you're going to need to know to teach that course. You're going to have to continue reading. And that's why, you know, publish or perish is a phrase in academics, engineering, and everywhere. So there needs to be this ongoing discussion and training for the ordained folks. But there's an enthusiasm that seems to be coming up from the pews now. And I think podcasts are in some way, and blogs are in some way encouraging that, but also because there's a market for that. The people are hungry for it too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's right.
I would add there, like, what we would be foolish not to make use of these things in that particular case, not to tap in and leverage that interest that people have. I don't want them to go other places, certain other places, to look for information or, you know, philosophy or theology. I want them to hear from their own elders and teachers. And so we should make use of this. It doesn't mean everybody needs to have a podcast, except Nate. You definitely need to have a podcast. But
my wife,
there are plenty of places where we need him. Yeah, yeah. But we should make use of these avenues that have been made available by interest. That's right. And
people will fill their, and you know what better for them That's to right. listen to on the way to home, on the way to work, or on the way home, than a podcast talking about the church and. Mm-hmm. And you know, especially not to keep tooting, you know, Polity Matters horn, but, you know, we need.
Please continue. Please.
I think I even have a graphic for Polity Matters.
Yeah, oh, no.
Here we go. Polity, you know, to keep tooting your horn, that we need to have a good understanding of the Book of Church Order when it's easy, so that when it gets hard, we know what to do. Right? If you're practicing good polity now, when it's easy and everybody's pretty much agreeing, then when you have a disagreement, you already know how to work it out.
Yeah. It's hard to do that, right? I went up to Fred a few years ago at Twin Lakes Fellowship and just said, hey, like, is it possible to learn the book without being involved in a judicial case? Like, how can I learn the rules for discipline without being involved? And he said, well, that's the best way to learn. And we chit-chatted about, is it possible to do mock trials or, like, get old information and records and kind of work through this stuff? Yeah. And some of that's been the impetus for Polity Matters. You know, okay, let's actually talk through this stuff. Now, when we get to the rules for discipline, I don't know what it's going to look like. You know, do a law and order, you know, type thing, I guess, and actually walk through stuff. But we have to learn this stuff before we get in the middle of it, because that's when we'll discover we know nothing unless we've been studying.
Yeah,
and it's really hard too. I call it the fog of war, right? When stuff hits the fan and things are going badly, your reading comprehension just drops. And so if you're trying to fish through this, I call it the blue brick. If you're trying to open the blue brick and and figure out what to do, and you haven't really kind of worked. I like case studies a lot. I use case studies in officer training and leadership development, because it's kind of like, here's a scenario, now what? And it kind of, it's the best tool, I think, to kind of mimic that fog of war. But it's just hard. It's really hard when it's, and that's the beauty of the Presbyterian system, is if something is happening to me, my ability to find what to do in that blue book is diminished. But if it's happening to someone I know and they're like, I can find the answers a lot quicker. And so the Presbyterian system is great for this, built-in relationships and help. And you know, studying and understanding the Book of Church Order before something happens, it helps you in the midst of, crisis or stuff, not, you know, going, it's stuff going sideways. So it's an important podcast. Everybody should you know, take a peek if they feel deficient in the BCO. That'll be a helpful podcast for them.
You mentioned, you know, mock trials. You know, I remember reading through, and I didn't read all, you know, 453 pages of the Jonesboro 7 record of the case, Ben. But, you know, reading through that, I was really brushing up on my BCO for the rules of discipline. That, wow, you know, this, that, you know, and just, yeah. So if you can get your hands on a thick record of the case from some old SJC trial, read through their report as well. But the record of the case is really going to be helpful to learn how to do the rules of discipline. And that's where we mess up. That's, you so know, true. That the PCA still gets dinged on social media. I saw one just today because there was a presbytery up north that messed up the rules of discipline and people didn't like it. And the guy got, you know, he walked free, so to speak. You know, Ryan,
on one of my all-time favorite quotes about the BCO, I think it was from a ruling elder, and I'm going to mess up this quote, but he basically said, all the BCO in the world is no replacement for the gumption and grit of elders to do what we're supposed to do. And so the biggest problem with the BCO is the same problem in the civil sphere that we have with the U.S. Constitution. It's the failure of the people that have the ability to do something to actually have the gumption to take action. And so I think that's a good reminder for us as elders that the answers are in the BCO, but the BCO is not going to come alive and do the work for us. We have to be willing to act like men and do our jobs. And that's when things go sideways, is that when people are looking for some wiggle room in the BCO to find a quick out rather than doing what needs to be done and doing the trudging hard work that is outlined at times for us in the Book of Church Order.
Yes. Yes. And so there's, you know, there's interest in our polity, and it sounds like you gentlemen don't think that's a bad thing, that these podcasts, blogs, discussions, videos, I mean, there's 20 some videos with Fred Greco and Dominic Aquila up on the More in the PCA website, just talking about our Book of Church Order. So interest in the church courts is a good thing, whether people are ordained or not ordained. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Certainly.
Well, what are some of the ways you found to get people interested and enthusiastic about the church courts? I know you've touched on some of them. How else do you try to go and deploy resources for your people so that they care about what's going on in the PCA?
Yeah, I make mentions during Sunday announcements at certain times. With the General Assembly coming in 2025 to our presbytery, I'm pretty much just going to bribe as many people from my church as I can to just go attend General Assembly for a day. You know, I think it's just so important for congregants to, you know, if they can drop in on the live stream for an hour or two, just to kind of see what's going on. Yeah. Even if they're not reading every overture, I exhort them. I'm like, look, I can resource you if you have the willingness to go, you know, look into things, you know, here's the overtures we're dealing with, be praying, but also, you know, look into these things. And, so that's all I can do, you know, is to just make people aware of resources they can look into. And then resource them when they have questions about stuff they're interested in. So
We've tried to kind of aim our ruling elders in these directions and trust that as they gain interest, their families and the folks around them in the church will follow. So we've started doing, we'll do not just GA prep where we work through the docket and all the documents, but we'll also do it for presbytery. We have presbytery 3 times a year stated. And so it's easier to meet, you know, for a few hours the week before presbytery and go through the document and just to give them a sense of how things work and how discussions are going to run and who's going to preach and what's the significant issues. And we like to send our ruling elder commissioners to General Assembly 2 years in a row, especially if it's their first time, because that first time is overwhelming. The second time is usually a lot of clarity. And so they can go the second time around and basically have an idea of what's going to happen. They can participate much more easily. And then if it was a few more years before they went back, no big deal. They've got kind of their feet under them. I can speak for my co-hosts on the podcast. Scott and Jared have both taught Sunday school classes on polity. They've basically taken Thomas Witherow's work, the Apostolic Church, and worked through that with their congregants. And so that at least will pique interest if folks want to look into the more, you know, the higher up things. But it also gives a good grounding just in the basic Presbyterian principles that make our churches what they are. And there is decent reading material out there available on polity and church courts. It's not riveting all the time, and some of it's very old, but it's very good and usually pretty short.
And I would say that, Ben, that's the challenge that I think a lot of teaching elders face when teaching that material is, how do I take this dry stuff and try to animate it a little bit? And sadly, it seems like many, particularly confessional and culturally conservative guys in the PCA, we have the charisma of that drywall behind me, you know? And so we've got to do a better job of, I think of taking that content and making it kind of come alive for our people. And that's hard. That's not, you can't teach that. I don't think, just kind of have to, either have it instinctively or sort it out through a lot of hard work. But that'd be another exhortation, I think, for fellow elders out there is, you know, that content's pretty dry and we got to figure out a way to make it more real life for people. Mm-hmm.
But so much of the BCO isn't dry. I mean, yeah, some of it is, but you know, so much of it is profoundly pastoral, edifying, and just and beautiful. But we assume that it's going to be dry and legal. But it's I think if we could get over that perception and stereotype about polity and about the work of the church courts, we could see even greater health in our Presbytery and General Assembly courts.
It's the format, isn't it? If it was a nice cloth bound, you know, no need to change it on a regular basis, it might be more approachable.
If it's, you
know,
for bedtime reading, and
yeah, right.
if J.I. Packer or Tim Keller had written a foreword and an introduction. You know, what encourages you men about the PCA right now? What concerns do you have as we kind of wrap up?
I think what encourages me is, and that is that I think the confessionals and the cultural conservatives are alive. You know, I think, not to pick on anybody, but I think, with Revoice and the revelation of the National Partnership emails, those were cards that were played at just the right time. Well, for them, the wrong time. And I think what it did is cause you know, there's that wing of the PCA, that tribe of the PCA, the evangelicals, and that tribe, when it comes to cultural issues like CRT and Revoice, they kind of can go one way or the other. They're not uniform in those things, in my opinion. And I think what happened was is that there was all these different issues so from outside the church that started to come in, and it kind of woke up a lot of, you know, maybe what you would call moderates in the PCA. And it also stirred up a lot of congregations and ruling elders to kind of just get out of cruise control. And like I mentioned earlier, you know, the confessional teaching elders, you know, we've discovered how to use platforms, you know, how to use, and it's happening, you know. So these are all encouraging things that there's people that are, another encouraging thing is that there's a lot of young guys in their late 20s, early 30s that are confessional and they're ready to get their hands dirty and to work and to earn it for the Some of us have basically made, oaths and pacts. It's like, I'm in the PCA, to the death. Like, we're not going anywhere. You know, we're planting our banner here, and regardless of how the wind shifts for 5 or 10 years at a time, we're digging in, and we're going to be faithful. And those are the things that excite me about the PCA. It's a mess, but it's the best mess around, that's something a friend of mine said at Covenant 10 years ago. And I think he was right then, and he's right now. So,
As far as encouragement goes, I want to tap into some comments Nate's already made about being a man, right? And pushing back against effeminacy and actually standing up for what we believe in. I'm encouraged because I hear a lot of elders in the church speaking like this and being concerned for being strong but meek and moving in good directions intentionally and standing up for what we believe in, as it were. And you know, because Ryan hasn't plugged my personal projects enough on this podcast already, I will share with y'all and your listeners, coming probably in about 6 weeks, we're going to have a new blog coming out called Reforming Men. It's basically going to be a place where we can send our tribe to talk about biblical masculinity. We're going to cover the gamut. There's several of us on an editorial board. There may be a podcast coming alongside of it at some point, since we don't have enough of those right now. But I'd love for folks to get excited about that, because right now I'm encouraged at men interested in learning how to be better men.
Yeah.
We need somewhere to send them to teach them that is accessible and easy and down to earth.
Not Moscow.
Well, we're not going to say that explicitly. Our whole angle is let's write about these things so that we don't have to think about other people that are writing about these things, but we think about the scriptures and about the standards above all else and what they teach us. So more or less, here we're coming to call all men to a Westminsterian masculinity, as it were.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Then that's one of my discouragements, I think, is the opposite of what you were just mentioning, is it feels like, it feels like we just don't have enough content for men, that directly deal with. And it also just feels like we're not getting, if we're depending upon the institutions of the PCA to do that for us, it's not gonna work out. I was really discouraged by the Covenant College promo video at GA. I've had more than one father of young adult children mention to me over the last 4 or 5 years that they've sent several children off to various Christian colleges, and when they visit Covenant College, their comment to me has been, "Man, the young men there are effeminate," and that should concern us as the PCA. Mm-hmm. That PCA adjacent people, non PCA members, are looking at all these Christian colleges and they're looking at the young men on campus and they're going, "Man, this isn't a reformed school, or this isn't a officially denominational institution over here, but the young men here are masculine." And all the young men at our institutions aren't given the same vibe. And and to piggyback off this again, not trying to be mean to anyone, but a woman made a comment to me. We had a guest preacher who it was an RUF minister, and she said, and it was like, it was because he didn't fit this stereotype, it dawned on her. She was like, a lot of RUF ministers, they speak with kind of an effeminate lisp, and he's the first one that I've encountered that doesn't. And I was like, wow, that's something, that's a problem, and these are the guys, if that's true, if that's her, that's this one woman's experience. But just think about the implications of that. These are the college pastors that are modeling for young men and young women what it means to be a man, a godly man who teaches the word. And again, that's one, it's anecdotal. That's not like from a D-Men survey of the past 20 years of RUF ministers. But those are concerning things. So Ben, when I hear about, a blog or a podcast like that, I think it's very necessary. And I know I'm going along here, Ryan, but just think about some of the arguments we've heard from the floor of the General Assembly in the last 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
Just very emotive, not, I think it's so problematic that we only have one seminary that I know of that teaches logic and rhetoric. That's Greenville. And it shows at Presbytery, it shows at General Assembly. It's not good. It's not, because if the elders, if the, I mean, we're supposed to be the, in terms of character and intelligence and ability to shepherd and reason and wrestle, we're supposed to be the cream of the crop. And the guys going to GA, I mean, if we can't make substantive arguments, man, that's scary for our churches. I mean, again, I won't mention any names because I don't want to pick on anybody, but in the past 5 years during nominations for moderator, you know, one guy makes the argument, vote for this guy. Here's his credentials. Here's his prowess in polity, which is what the moderator of the general, this is what this is. This is the Super Bowl of polity. You've got to have polity aces up your sleeves. You've got to be a Jedi master at polity to do this. And then the other guy,
able to laugh at yourself.
And be able to laugh at yourself, admit your mistake, and keep on rolling. And then the other guy gets up and is like, I love this guy. This guy's great. He's a great at this. He's great. There's no credentials in polity. There's no, and it was, you know, if this guy was, it's just, it was tough. It was hard to hear, because it was the logic was just not, the rationale was empty. If we continue to get that, and what does that say to our sons, you know? So I think, and to our daughters, you know, what kind of stability does that offer? I mean, Ben, you've got four daughters.
I do.
Man. I mean, so, just think about what's it going to be like in 20 to 25 years when men come asking for hands in marriage, and it's like they've been formed in this ecosystem where reason and accountability and logic and cohesive thinking is just absent, because that's what was modeled for them. And then they went off to college and they were trained in institutions where the professors are helping reinforce this effeminate culture. So it's just, you know, we have to think 20 to 30 years down the road and start shaping institutions. That's right. And making decisions in our churches and in our ministries today, you know, that will shift, or that will create the foundation for what we leave to our children and grandchildren. So anyway, that's.
Ryan, I've got one other thought that kind of will jump back to earlier, I think, and in terms of concerns. I was thinking about it when we were talking about, you know, ruling elders and General Assembly, and is the assembly broken and all these things. I do think right now I'm concerned with the strong public focus on General Assembly and even to some degree on presbyteries. You know, I'm not going to fault Scott for his document, his spreadsheet that's out there on all how the way presbyteries go. But I was reading in Morton Smith's commentary on the BCO the other day for my morning devotions. And, you know, preservation of purity doesn't happen at General Assembly. It happens in the congregations and in the presbyteries when men are being examined and subsequently approved and then ordained for ministry. Mm-hmm. That's how the church is going to go the way our ordained men go. And most of our ordained men, even though we have a ton of teaching elders, are our ruling elders and our deacons. And so I think it's incumbent upon us to get back to that grassroots and not go to General Assembly expecting that to change everything in the PCA, because it's actually going to be changed from the bottom, really and actually be changed from the bottom. Doesn't matter what we have on paper, what kind of men you have serving, and I suppose this ties into the manliness conversation too. That's really what's going to influence the church for the good or the worse in the long run.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
I remember David Hall, pastor at Midway in Marietta, Georgia, giving an address to some pastors gathered for Reformation Worship Conference 1 year. Superb conference. It'll be in Savannah this year. If you've never gone, I'd certainly recommend that you go. But a number of years ago, David Hall, he was talking about how it's expensive to go to General Assembly. And this is, by the way, this is pre-2018. It's expensive to go to GA. And if you can't go to GA, that's fine. Go to Presbytery. And also build up your local session. that mm-hmm. don't think if you can't go to GA that it's over, that you can't participate. You know, all politics is local. Somebody said that, and it's true. You know, in the civil sphere, but it's also true in terms of church polity. Mm-hmm. Build up local session, and get those guys to presbytery. Have a strong bench in your church. You know, don't just invest in your elders, invest in the young men in your church, and don't just ignore the women. Invest in the young women so that they know what kind of man that they should be looking for, and not settling for just somebody.
Yeah, that's right.
All right. Well, anything else, gentlemen, for the good of the cause before we say goodbye?
Thanks for having us, Ryan. Really appreciate it. Good discussion.
Thank you. This was excellent, I thought. Always like to have people who know more than I do on, so thanks. Thank you both for coming on and carrying the conversation.
Yeah. Good to see you, Ryan.
Likewise. Thanks for joining the conversation on the Westminster Standard, which is the podcast of Jude 3. For additional resources or to make a donation, visit our website, jude3pca.org. It really is encouraging to see how greater interest in the church court has produced greater involvement by ruling elders and teaching elders alike, which has resulted in greater health for the Presbyterian Church in America. Come back in 2 weeks' time as we welcome ruling elder Matt Lee, as well as teaching elders Zach Roth and James Bruce, for a discussion on what the exceptions to the standards granted by presbyteries indicates about the health of the PCA. Ruling Elder Lee has conducted a study of how the General Assembly has considered various differences with the standards, which has given insight into the growing health and vibrancy within the PCA as we see the PCA taking more seriously her mission to be faithful to the Scriptures, true to the Reformed faith, and obedient to the Great Commission. I'll talk to you then.